This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Retired Admiral James Stavridis served in the Navy for 37 years. He was the 16th NATO Supreme Allied Commander from 2009 to 2013, leading operations in Afghanistan, Libya, and the Balkans. He was also commander of U.S. Southern Command. As such, James Stavridis has witnessed war and brinkmanship from the bridges of aircraft carriers, cruisers, and destroyers. And again, he and those under his command faced moments where time was short, risk was high, and big decisions had to be made. In the years since, he's thought a lot about how to read a situation, think clearly, and decide whether to act or wait, whether to play it safe or take a high-stakes gamble. And through it all, how to best think and adapt to the moment. Or in a world where urgency and complexity make doing just that, thinking clearly and adapting that much harder, how to best do that. Well, Admiral Stavridis is out with a new book titled To Risk It All, Nine Conflicts and the Crucible of Decision, where he writes about nine key naval battles in U.S. history and the lessons they can teach us all. Admiral Stavridis joins us today from Westlake, Texas. James Stavridis, welcome back to On Point.
Meghna, terrific to be with you, and thanks for taking a risk by interviewing me.
Yeah, it seems like a pretty low-stakes risk to me, Admiral, to be perfectly honest. But let me just sort of get your take. Why did you think that a book about the lessons we can all draw from naval decision-making felt right to you now?
Well, first and foremost, people ought to write about what they actually know about. You know, what a concept. And as a naval officer, eventually becoming a naval admiral, I studied each of these situations very deeply. But what occurred to me, as you teed up so nicely in that introduction, is that many of these lessons are portable. In other words, just because they are framed in the book in a naval context, means that they can also be played when you're facing a moment of real crisis in your personal life. Example would be an active shooter situation. How about an automobile accident late at night, you're driving by it? What about if you're on a beach and someone suddenly is drowning and there are no lifeguards this summer because of lack of lifeguards, but you're a pretty good swimmer? You know, these are moments of real crisis. And I think, again, the lessons from the book are quite transportable. Mm.
So let's dig into some of those lessons here. I'd actually like to start with a somewhat more contemporary example that you bring. The book does go all the way back to, what, the 18th century and several key U.S. naval battles then. But I want to start with something that happened in 2009. So that is when Somali pirates raided the cargo ship Maersk Alabama and took its captain, Richard Phillips, hostage on one of the ship's lifeboats. Folks might remember that. Now, the USS Bainbridge was one of two naval vessels that came or was assigned to help rescue the ship and crew. And here is what happened, according to a Navy spokesman announcing the successful rescue of Captain Phillips at a press briefing.
U.S. Naval Forces rescued Captain Richard Phillips, the master of the motor vessel Maersk Alabama, 7:19 p.m. local time here in Bahrain, and we're happy to say that Captain Phillips is safe. After his rescue, he was taken aboard the Norfolk, Virginia-based guided missile destroyer, the USS Bainbridge. I could not be more proud to represent all the men and women in uniform who worked tirelessly to make this rescue possible.
Now, who commanded the Bainbridge? Rear Admiral Michelle Howard, and she gets a chapter in your book. So tell us more about Rear Admiral Howard and the lessons learned from the Bainbridge's experience.
Yeah, this one really puts a smile on my face. I wish you and all the listeners could see it. This is one of the decisions that turns out very, very well. There are several in the book, To Risk It All, that don't turn out quite as well. We'll get to those, but you've picked a good one to start with. Michelle Phillips, I've known her since she was a midshipman at the academy. I have mentored her. She's not physically imposing. She's about 5 feet tall, African-American, broke every barrier she ever saw, and came up in her career, first African-American woman to command a warship, first African-American woman to become a one-star admiral. You get the idea. Mm-hmm. She eventually will retire just recently, actually, as a four-star admiral. So at the time of the rescue of Captain Phillips, and I'm sure many folks have seen the movie, Michelle is in command of a task force of a group of ships, including USS Bainbridge, and she is orchestrating this operation. And she knows, here's the fundamental point, she knows that hostage rescues ultimately turn on a moment. There's a huge amount of planning that goes into it. There's intelligence gathering. There's putting all the pieces in play. But at some crucial moment, a commander has to make a decision on the spot, now, now, now. Picture this. The Bainbridge is rocking and rolling in the sea, as a destroyer will. On the fantail are SEAL snipers, the best in the business, SEAL Team 6, the National Mission Force, same folks that got bin Laden. Down in a small boat, rocking even more, are Captain Phillips and the Somali pirates. Michelle Howard gave permission to that destroyer to take the shot. Three shots rang out, three pirates went down, Captain Phillips saved. But it could have gone so easily in a different direction. And that really is the point where Michelle Howard had to risk it all, really risking the life of Captain Phillips, but also her own career, her reputation, the Navy's reputation, the SEAL's reputation. She made that choice. And let me tell you from personal experience, pulling the trigger in a hostage rescue is one of the hardest decisions commanders make.
So we're going to get to your personal experience in a few minutes, Admiral Stavridis. But of course, the question that everyone wonders is what's going through the head of the decision maker at the time, right? Because as you point out now and in the book, it was Rear Admiral Howard who had the authority to authorize the deadly use of force if the Bainbridge determined that it was needed. She was where the buck stopped, essentially. So what can we learn from how she made that decision to take that chance?
Yeah, I'll give you three quick points, and we unpackage it in more depth in the book to risk it all. But first, intelligence gathering, preparation, all the things that happen before you have to make that crucial decision, fusing all the resources together. Number two is weighing the outcomes and realizing that some of them are very bad. Too often, people have what I call outcome bias. In other words, they're too biased toward, oh yeah, this is all going to come out perfectly, and all they can focus on is how terrific it's going to be if everything works out, or the opposite. And I myself have been stymied in hostage rescue situations, getting overly focused on negative consequences. But the key is decision makers, really good ones, can very quickly size up both the good and the bad that comes out of the decision. And then third and finally, you have to be able to step back, emotionally detach yourself, and make at the moment of decision the best call you can. You know, the best book of leadership ever written, Magna, I think, is The Godfather by Mario Puzo. And among many other things the Don says, a comment he makes has always stuck with me. He's talking to his son, Santino, and he says, never make the mistake of hating your enemies. It clouds your judgment. Mm. In other words, detaching yourself emotionally to make that decision at the point of decision. Michelle did all three of those things perfectly. Mm. That's why the decision came out well.
You know, I have to correct myself because a few minutes ago I said that Rear Admiral Howard had commanded the Bainbridge. She wasn't in direct command of the Bainbridge, but she was commanding the overall operation to rescue Captain Phillips. You know, so in the media, we tend to have a bias towards covering decisions that were made in order to affect some kind of action, right? There's also a whole set of decision making that takes into account the sea of information, if I can put it that way, the relative risks, what's at stake, et cetera. And the best decision that person comes up with that period and at that point in time is to do nothing, right? There's always the do nothing option. Mm-hmm. How much of that do you think factors into thinking about how to make good decisions? Because in this case, with Rear Admiral Howard, we're talking about someone who decided to go for it. But are there examples in the book or, you know, from your own life where you figured that doing nothing was actually the best option?
Indeed. There are such examples, you know, staying with your nautical theme of a sea of information. I'll give you a ship handling example. Sometimes when we're teaching a young ensign how to handle a ship, how to drive like a big, huge destroyer around the pier, a young ensign will often want to left standard rudder, right standard rudder, port engine back one third, starboard engine ahead two thirds. They throw all these rudder commands on the ship. But sometimes we'll tell an ensign, you got to just stop and let all of those factors come to fruition. You've got to see what's going to happen with this big, massive ship you're driving. So yes, there are moments when you just got to stop and see what the effect is. In terms of a specific decision where in my own case, I failed to pull the trigger because I was so awash in information and was so worried about a hostage outcome was in Colombia when I was commander of U.S. Southern Command in charge of military activities south of the United States. So in the country of Colombia, we had three American hostages who were being held by a terrorist group known by its initials in Spanish, the FARC. And the FARC had held these Americans for several years under terrible conditions. My special forces teams were coming to me saying, Admiral, we've got a plan. We can take a shot. We're closing in on them. I kept asking for more information, because I was so concerned about the well-being of the hostage, that the mission come out well. And I held fire too long. They slipped away. Ultimately, we were able to get them about another year later, but that's a year out of their lives. If I'd made a better decision, I sometimes think they might have come home sooner.
Well, the problem is that we can never know about the truth of a counterfactual. So we're going to talk more about the examples that you have in the new book, To Risk It All, when we come back in just a moment. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today, retired Admiral James Stavridis is with us. He's out with a new book called To Risk It All, Nine Conflicts and the Crucible of Decision. So, Admiral Stavridis, before we get into some of the more specific examples in the book, my mind, to be honest, is still sort of stuck at or mulling over the decision to do nothing and how sometimes that may be important. And I think do nothing is maybe the wrong phrase. The decision to exercise restraint, let me put it that way, because it seems to me that especially in the military, and I would, you know, I presume the Navy, especially given the fact that so much happens out of the public's eye on the seas around the world, that do we, again, I'm thinking about the public, undervalue the moments when a military decision maker decided that the best thing to do is to practice restraint? Because I imagine there are lots of examples that you know and can think of when the decision to do something might have actually ended up spilling into an even larger conflict.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Let me give you another example from my own experience. Let's go back to the mid-1980s. And the U.S. Navy is escorting oil tankers in and out of the Arabian Gulf. And my job at that time, I'm the tactical action officer on an Aegis cruiser, so much capability to shoot down incoming aircraft. We see an incoming aircraft. Many in the ship believed it to be an Iranian jet that was coming to attack us. We were in and around the Strait of Hormuz. I had the firing key in my hand. We just about took that shot. Something told me to hold back. My captain reached over and kind of put his hand on my forearm, and we held back, knowing that if it was an Iranian, the possibility existed that it could have attacked us. We didn't take the shot. We didn't shoot down that air contact that we saw very clearly on our radar. Magnet turned out to be an Iranian civilian aircraft, an Airbus full of civilians. We held back and didn't take that shot. Tragically, in that same campaign, some months later, another cruiser, USS Vincennes, took that shot in very similar circumstances, shot down a civilian aircraft, one of the most tragic days in the history, in my view, of the U.S. Navy. The first instance is an example of where doing nothing was the right decision. In the second instance, a tactical action officer felt the need to defend his ship. He took the shot, and it ended tragically. Mm. So, yes, there are many instances where moments of decision and crisis can turn on doing nothing, which avoids the kind of tragedy I outlined a moment ago.
So what's more important for us to understand? Is it that, you know, that that almost mystical something that told you and your fellow commander who put his hand on you, like to pause for that moment? Or is it more important to understand the structure around the decision making at that time, which led to the possibility of exercising that restraint?
It's a bit of both, but what we really unpackage in the book, To Risk It All, is the preparation, the intelligence gathering, the resources that you put into the decision before that moment of crisis, all the training I'd received, all the leadership I'd learned from my commanding officer. And then at that moment of decision, something we spoke about a moment ago in the case of Rear Admiral Michelle Howard, that ability to detach yourself emotionally. And then a third thing we haven't talked about is the ability to change your mind. Mm-hmm. So in a moment of crisis, you can see that incoming aircraft. And at some point in that scenario, I was quite convinced it was a hostile Iranian aircraft. And yet I changed my mind as a result of the combination of things that you and I just discussed. And I think that ability to change your mind in a moment of crisis is also an important point.
So let's get some more examples of from the nine naval battles in the book. I'm glad that we did start out with Rear Admiral Howard, because decisions, affirmatively made decisions that end up successful, are a great place to start. But you do also talk about things that went horribly wrong. Like, what do you think is, what's one of your favorite examples from the book on that?
Well, certainly the saddest example in the book, in my view, is from 1968, and it is the story of USS Pueblo. And this is a very small naval ship that is built strictly for intelligence gathering. It has basically no armament on it. In January of that year, in the middle of the winter, the Pueblo is sent on a mission. It's operating off the coast of North Korea. It's in international waters, has every right to be there. Shamefully, the Navy did not put aircraft overhead, did not have a destroyer standing by to protect it. And the North Koreans sortied in force, surrounded the USS Pueblo, and said to the captain, either you surrender your ship or we are going to sink your ship. And if any of your crew survive and are in the water, we're then going to machine gun them. We're going to kill all of you. So he was faced with a terrible choice. And there were many challenges in that moment. But part of what's going through the captain's mind, his name is Lieutenant Commander Lloyd Bucher. What's going through his mind, of course, is the Navy tradition and Navy regulation says a captain will never surrender his or her ship while he or she has the means to resist. And so he's asking himself, do I have the means to resist here or not? He's got some pistols, he's got some rifles, he has a 50 caliber that's frozen up on the forward part of the ship. He makes the decision, personally, I think it was the right one, to surrender the ship, to live to fight another day, because he felt he had no means of resistance. He and his crew are imprisoned. They're tortured for a year. Finally, we negotiate their release. They come home not as heroes. They come home and Lloyd Bucher is subjected to a court of inquiry, which recommends he be court-martialed. Ultimately, the Secretary of the Navy, I think, made the right decision and overturned that. But the point is, Bucher's career and in many ways his life were simply ruined. He had this terrible moment of choice. I call the title of that chapter to conclude, No Way Out, because I just don't think Bucher had a good option. That's why I included in the book to make the point sometimes there are no good options, unfortunately.
And there isn't even a sort of a best of the worst options in a case like that?
Yeah, and that's what I would say Bucher took. Other very senior naval officers will tell you, nope, as long as he had a single pistol with six shots in it, he should have fired that at the North Koreans and taken the consequences. I think he took the least worst option of surrendering a ship. And that's precisely the point of including that very tragic story in there.
You know, one of the threads here that I'm hearing in all of these stories is, like you say, there's the gather the intelligence, understand the timeline, leave room to change your mind. All of these structural things that that can go into better decision-making through the examples in your book. But there's also in each of them that sort of, I don't want to call it magic moment because I don't like calling things magic, but there is that moment of decision-making, a series of things that actually happens in the brain of the individual. In writing and researching and sharing these nine examples from naval history, were you able to sort of discern any commonalities of the things that were happening in the minds of these naval decision makers as in the moment where they had to choose what to do?
We'll never know. We can't really step into the mind of another human being. But what you can do, and in my research, went back and read their testimonies where they existed. So in the case of Lieutenant Commander Lloyd Bucher, I went back and read his memoir, a very heart-wrenching story where he lays out the entire case. In another story that we tell of the captain of the Theodore Roosevelt, who lost his career when he pushed the Navy too hard in the face of COVID, to bring the ship into port. And in that case, I was able to actually interview Captain Brett Crozier. Obviously, the other eight figures had already sailed onto the great fleet in the sky. But you do the research, and then you balance that, because let's face it, everyone has their own version of events. You balance that with your own judgment. In my case, having been a naval commander of ships, of groups of ships, of carrier strike groups, I could kind of put myself in the mindset of many of these individuals in the book. So you bring that to the equation. And then finally, you look at the larger history, the context and the framework. And if you put all that together, I think I have created a pretty accurate view of what happened in the mind of these individuals and how they balance those choices. But back to where we started, ultimately, you never really know. Everyone's mind works in different ways. I'll close with something that I find in many, many very capable, high-stress decision makers. It is a phrase I trip across often in interviewing people in this case. It's time slows down. Time slows down. And that's so counterintuitive. For many people, it all becomes a blur of panic. But for good decision makers, time slows down. And you can train yourself in that way. You can help yourself learn how to focus and slow down as you make decisions and kind of cut the emotion out. It's hard to do, but over the course of a life and study and thinking and preparing, you can help yourself to create a sense that time is slowing down when you're in a moment of crisis.
Okay, so there's another example that I'd love to talk about from To Risk It All, and it's the story of Admiral Will Bull Halsey. Now, we've just got a little bit of a newsreel describing him from the Second World War, and here it is.
They affectionately called him Bull Halsey. He won worldwide recognition in World War II. He took over the South Pacific Area Command in 42 and ranged destructively from the Solomons to the Philippines to the China Sea. More than 2,800 enemy planes were destroyed or damaged by his forces in a single month in 1945.
Ranged destructively. Gotta love the language of those old newsreels. But tell us about Admiral Halsey.
Yeah. So let me start by saying I'm standing at attention and saluting. Now, he's a remarkable figure, and there's a lot to love about Bull Halsey, including the fact that he became the oldest and is still the oldest individual ever to go through Navy pilot training and win the so-called Wings of Gold. You know, Shades of Top Gun 2 just came out. He did that in his early 50s, if you can imagine that. And he was a swashbuckling figure, and his sailors honestly loved him. And the nation came to have a great deal of affection for him. But he made a decision at the height of the largest naval battle in history, called the Battle of Leyte Gulf, fall of 1945. Huge number of ships, both on the U.S. side and the Japanese side. And Admiral Halsey, who was always a bit reckless and someone who had a pretty high opinion of his own intuition and often made decisions kind of off the cuff, decided he looked to the north and he saw what he was sure was the main Japanese fleet approaching. He took almost all of his striking combat power, his carriers, his battleships, his cruisers, and they charged up to the north. The bad news, Magna, is that he left almost undefended the enormous landing force, tens of thousands U.S. soldiers and U.S. Marines who were about to come back to the Philippines, about to land on the beaches of the Philippines. They had no protection. Here's the bad news. Through another strait comes the real Japanese strike force. The one Halsey chased up to the north was a decoy. Fortunately, there were still a handful of these tiny little destroyers left to defend that landing force. They were a tenth of the size of these enormous Japanese battleships that came through that strait. But they charged them knowing they would probably be destroyed. Most of them were sunk, many of their commanding officers killed, hundreds of crew members killed, but they bluffed the Japanese main force, and the Japanese main force withdrew. Halsey had time to come back. So it's a story of recklessness, of a bad decision, where he was rescued by luck and by the courage of these destroyer captains back where he had abandoned, frankly, the landing force. It was a bad decision, and it's a good example of how sometimes that tendency to simply charge at the problem, it feels so right, and yet it's the wrong decision.
Right. Okay. So, because as you're telling the story of Halsey, at the risk of oversimplification, I hear you describing a man who, because things felt so right, essentially like was serving his ego in that moment, yeah, and not serving the other tenets that you put out in the book. And so for us all, then, here's a really direct lesson to be drawn. Things can feel really good to us as individuals, but that doesn't necessarily mean that makes it the right decision. But how do you differ that? How do you distinguish that from the almost intuitive sense that you talked about earlier?
Let's contrast Bill Halsey with a much lesser known admiral, but a four-star admiral named Raymond Spruance. And Halsey and Spruance were actually alternated in command of these massive strike fleets by their boss, Chester Nimitz, operating back at Pearl Harbor. Ray Spruance was almost professorial. He was so thoughtful, so measured, so knee bone connected to the ankle bone, get the right conclusion. And you know, frankly, what you want is sometimes you need the recklessness of Halsey, and sometimes you need that studious, careful, thoughtful Ray Spruance. But I'll give you a bottom line. Over time, my view, Spruance was the better admiral. And I believe that there's always a time, particularly in war, where you literally, like the title of the book, risk it all. But more often than not, success in the military and success in our life situations is based on preparation, thoughtfulness, cutting the emotion out of the equation.
Mm. Well, we're joined today by retired Admiral James Stavridis. His new book is To Risk It All, Nine Conflicts and the Crucible of Decision. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how Admiral Stavridis sees some real-time decision-making happening in one particular war zone in the world right now. And then also, again, how we can apply these lessons that he's drawing from naval history in all our lives. So that's what we'll talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just a quick heads up on a show we're working on for Wednesday. It has to do with work and how it seems like a lot of Americans are looking for something from work that they used to look for or find in community or in religion. And that is that feeling of spirituality, of transcendence, about being connected to and changing the world, of that feeling of profound meaning. Which now people are told or believe they can get through work? Maybe not. We're going to be talking to Professor Carolyn Chen, who has been doing an anthropological analysis of some folks in Silicon Valley who seek transcendence through their technological innovations, but we want to broaden it out to everyone else. Do you seek to find meaning in work? And if so, is it the same kind of meaning that you find in community, in civic groups, or in religious groups? And if you are belonging to one, I'd love to hear the comparison. Or do you not belong to a civic group or a religious or spiritual group of any kind and seek that same kind of connection instead at work? Is that a good idea or not? Call us with your stories at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. We're going to be talking about transcendence and work, or let me put it more specifically, seeking transcendence where you work. That's for Wednesday. Today, we're speaking with retired Admiral James Stavridis. His new book is called To Risk It All, Nine Conflicts and the Crucible of Decision. And we've got an excerpt of the book, by the way, at onpointradio.org. Admiral Stavridis, so we have to talk about how you're seeing some of the lessons that you draw from the American naval battles in terms of decision-making going on right now, specifically in Ukraine, of course, because we have two very different kinds of leaders with Vladimir Putin in Russia and Volodymyr Zelensky in Ukraine. So first of all, let's just focus on Zelensky for a second. What do you see him doing that epitomizes some of the best qualities of decision-making that you write about in the book?
Boy, I have been so happy to watch Volodymyr Zelensky meet his moment. And I think it is not an overstatement to say he is approaching Winston Churchill territory in the ability to inspire his people, the ability to communicate so powerfully and with such articulate phrasing and such use of iconography and image. Think about him changing out of those business suits into tactical gear. He again and again has stepped up in this moment. And let's start with why is that? And I think to the point of the book, To Risk It All, here's a man who is quite literally risking it all on the front lines. Don't forget, at the start of this war, he was offered a ride out of Ukraine by the West, saying, hey, get out of there, set up a government in exile like Charles de Gaulle did in France in the Second World War. We'll help you. We'll give you that ride. We'll set you up. He said, quote, I don't need a ride. I need more ammunition, end quote. That's going to be carved on the side of the parliament before this whole thing is over in Kyiv, I bet. So why? It's because when he looks over his shoulder, what does he see? He sees his wife, his children, who were on the hit list the Russians put out. He sees his parents, his elders, his society, his language, his civilization. Everything is on the line. So here you have what has turned out to be a very talented individual meeting his moment with every motivation to succeed. It's frankly been a joy to watch. Despite all the terrible things that are happening to his people, so often we don't see that. Think Afghanistan, the fall of Kabul. President Ashraf Ghani grabbed a helicopter, a bag of cash, and left. Volodymyr Zelensky is fighting it out. So much to admire about him.
Well, so I will say that people have often focused, I know this wasn't the only thing you focused on, but others have often focused on Zelensky's choice of wardrobe here. I also see that as just the canny move of a mm-hmm. former performer.
Sure.
Who knows that there are key things you have to do to win the hearts and minds of
yep.
folks, and stepping into a role fully, including wardrobe, is part of that. But I heard you also describe there are other things, many other things in the past 100 plus days that Zelensky has done, including today, actually, he's at the front lines in Ukraine, physically there, rather than having, he's not even in Kyiv Central per se today. But, I'm also looking at the list of lessons that you draw. And I'm wondering, ironically, some of them, in a sense, do apply to Vladimir Putin as well. You have, mm-hmm. be determined, okay? Mm-hmm. Don't get emotionally involved in people. Be prepared to execute. Focus on your people, but don't be paralyzed with fear for their well-being. I don't see Putin as being totally concerned with the well-being of his troops. So, but yet, I am going to hazard a guess here, Admiral, that you don't look upon Vladimir Putin as an admirable leader in this moment.
Not in the least. He is someone who has taken the qualities, some of which you mentioned, and carried them to an extreme in a way that what could have been his greatest strength has become his greatest weakness. And what I mean by that is, I think he is deeply, deeply emotionally involved here. He has placed his ego at the top of the hierarchy of needs of his country and is going to take his country's economy, its global reputation, down with him. He seems unable to change his mind when confronted with a completely different fact pattern than he presumed was the case when he executed this invasion. It's funny you use the word execution. I suspect there are some executions going on in and around Moscow of generals and admirals. Again, Putin is obviously the villain of the piece from the Western perspective, but certainly he is determined. I'll give him that one. I think on the rest of the counts, he is taking it to such an extreme that it becomes counterproductive in terms of trying to get to a successful outcome.
Mm. So I am looking at some of these sort of big takeaways here that you have from the book To Risk It All. Understanding, I'm just going to go over them briefly. Gather all the intelligence, right? Beware of confusing assumptions, things you think are true, and facts, things that are indisputable. We could spend a whole hour just on that one, honestly.
Indeed.
But understand the timeline, very important. Consider all the possible outcomes of your decision. Evaluate resources, which is really interesting because you also say that requires clear-eyed skepticism. We talked about focusing on your people. Do not be too emotionally involved in people. Have a dispassionate distance. Be willing to change your mind. Be determined, and others. it seems to me that these are actually all ways of being that are quite applicable outside the urgency of a moment where it is a life and death moment. Because I'm looking at this list and trying to and thinking, I kind of want to practice all of these all of the time, no matter what I'm doing in life.
Indeed. I feel as though that's a very good tactical list of how you could structure decisions you have to make about very huge things in your life, like who you're going to marry, where you're going to go to school, what job are you going to take on, where's your career going. I think there are also, for moments of real crisis and stress, as we talked about, that moment when you're in a church and a gunman comes in. Think of Dr. John Chang several weeks ago, one of these terrible active shooter situations in Laguna Woods, California. He's 52 years old. He's got two children. He's in church with his mother. A shooter walks in. He charges the shooter to protect the congregation. And the congregation is able to subdue the shooter. Dr. John Chang is the only person killed. He becomes a real hero in that moment. But let's step back from that list of things. And let me just tell you two big things, Meghna. And one is you have to know what you value. Mm-hmm. You have to know what you value. And you can't decide that on the spur of the moment. And what I mean by that is you have to know, like Zelensky does, how deeply you value your country. You have to know how you value your community, your parents, the way Dr. John Chang did. You have to know and think about what you really value in life. And that takes time to understand that. And then the second big thing that applies to all of this is you got to know yourself. You got to know whether you have the ability physically, emotionally, in terms of your tolerance for risk, to take on a very big challenge. And again, that can be as applicable as you're standing on the beach, someone is drowning out there, but you're not a strong swimmer. You've got to know that about yourself. You have to have self-knowledge. So know what you value and know yourself. Those are, I think, the two uber takeaways here. What you and I have been discussing are, I think, a very good list of tactical things that can help you through these moments.
Oh, the tactical is applicable at the individual level and then also at a broader, I'd say, systemic level. And
yes.
Do you see some of these tactics for good decision making as part of the culture of decision making in American politics right now?
I wish that they were as fully inculcated as I suspect you would agree, and many of our listeners would agree. But unfortunately, in today's political climate, I think, for example, too many decisions are based on emotion without really examining all the facts. Too many decisions are being made without thoroughly scrubbing the intelligence. And back to your comment about assumptions and facts, we're having a great deal of problems in American politics these days, in my view, differentiating between what people at opposite ends of the political spectrum assume is correct and what is actually factually correct. And then third and finally, just to pick three things, our decision makers tend to get locked into positions and then seem unable to change their mind.
Right.
And a perfect example, of course, is unfolding in front of us in the world of active shooters and the horrible events at Uvalde. You would hope more of our leaders would find the courage and the ability to change their minds if they have been locked up against various aspects of gun safety and various aspects of background checks and red flag laws. Too many of our leaders seem locked into these positions, despite the fact that poll after poll shows the American public has a positive view toward many of these kinds of restrictions. Mm-hmm. So I think our politics could do with less emotion, more sensible gathering of intelligence and differentiation of fact and assumption, and the ability to change minds when facts weren't doing so.
You know, Admiral, I'm going to take it a step further, and I'm going to say that I'm going to bring some clear-eyed skepticism to this conversation, because as I feel right now that, in fact, the American political system and the politicians and lawmakers that make up that system are participating in a system which has actually driven out all of the essential things that you talk about are needed for good mm-hmm. decision making. I am that skeptical about it because, mm-hmm. I mean, everything, the willing to change your mind part, huge. Don't get emotionally involved in people who are roadblocks. That seems like we do the opposite now in American politics. Being ruthlessly honest about the range of outcomes. Politicians don't do that. They focus on the one that they think is going to sort of most titillate or excite or satisfy a narrow constituency in the United States. Do you think that there's anything that can be done to reinvigorate the kinds of tactics that you see are essential to good decision-making? Because when we talk about decisions that are made by presidents, by members of the House, by senators, governors, et cetera, name your political leader, these are decisions that have impacts on thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions of people. Don't we have a duty? I'll use that, a duty to mm-hmm. try and create a system where the best decisions can be made.
I'll give you three practical ideas and then a thought that's a little less practical in the immediate moment, but may come to pass. The first is we need to do more to celebrate service, to celebrate those who serve others. And here I don't mean simply the military and thank you for your service. I mean consciously celebrating those who serve us as teachers, as diplomats, as police officers, as firefighters, as medical personnel on the front lines of COVID. There's a lot to celebrate in terms of service, and we should incentivize that, talk about it, and celebrate our successes, because those are the opposite of the challenges you just made, mm-hmm. the idea and culture of service. Number two, education. This gets into assumptions and facts. We put a supercomputer known as an iPhone in the hands of a child when he or she is 9.5 years old. 9.5 years old. We don't educate them to differentiate between the flow of garbage on the internet, the lies, the fake, the assumption, and the reality. And that can be done as an educational aspect. And it also gets in, Meghna, into the idea of everything from apprenticeship programs. Our whole educational system could grapple with some of these challenges. And third and finally, you know, there is the good old fashioned solution here. It's called the ballot box. And that is finding candidates who do exemplify those kind of conditions. And I know you're very skeptical about that. And so am I. And here I come on to maybe not realistic this moment, but in the future, you know, it does not say in the Constitution that there shall always be two political parties, Republican and Democrat. We didn't start out with them. We started out with Whigs, Federalists, Nationalists. We've had a lot of parties in this country. Over time, maybe we need to break the lock on the two ends of the political spectrum.
Well, James Stavridis, the new book is To Risk It All, 9 Conflicts and the Crucible of Decision. Admiral Stavridis, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you so much for coming back to the show.
Thank you for conducting such a risky interview.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.